This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Welcome to this podcast, Season 7, Episode 27. My name is Tim Mitra. I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined by Jonathan Kuhlein in Jacksontown, New Brunswick.
Hello there, kid.
We also have Jaime Lopez Jr. on the line in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
It's going very well, sort of. We're not going to go there. All right. Let's just start off with some fact check. The Oneer, which we were talking about last week, I hadn't watched the studio, but I'm now caught up to episode 4. The Oneer, which is about Sarah Pauly making a one-shot movie or film clip, and director, head of studio, trying not to mess it up. That entire episode is, in fact, a Oneer. It's a one take. Just pretty cool. Pretty cool format.
I was kind of wondering about that because they talk about, they want to do a real Oneer, you know, in the universe, right? They want to do that movie as a Oneer. He's like, we're not going to do, like, you know, camera wipes and pans and other things to hide it. And then they do that right around that time. It made me wonder if it was a series of Oneers.
You know, in this particular thing?
Yeah.
The episode itself?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm pretty sure it was a Oneer. Look, one shot take me. It looked to me like it was, right? And because, I mean, yeah, right up to the even, like, you know, driving to the set and then driving away from the set, you know, like, it was just great way to bookend it, right? In fact, I think they even talk about bookending in the one of the running jokes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and then, you know, so it's funny because I got to go back now Jonathan, are you watching this show?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because got to go back and watch, because this latest episode that came out, I think, yesterday was Chinatown. I've never seen the movie Chinatown, but they kept making these gags and towards the fact that it was kind of like that. So I think each one of the episodes has got some sort of, like, inside baseball meta kind of exercise, right? So, yeah, it's cool. Anyway. That being said, let's move on and talk about some real movie magic that just happened this weekend.
Yeah, I don't know that anybody knew this was necessarily going to happen, especially if you look at the Rotten Tomatoes rating for Minecraft movie. It's like 40-some% from the critics and 80-some, like high 80-some for the fans. And with that, the Minecraft movie, or a Minecraft movie, as it's technically titled, set the record for the biggest opening ever for a video game adaptation. It has taken down the Super Mario Brothers movie.
Wow. No way.
Yeah. This article, as of, when was this, Sunday, April 6th, said 157 million domestically, per the folks at Engadget. You know, that's a pretty big opening. What was the total for Mario Brothers? Was it like a billion?
146, it says. 146 million.
So that was opening weekend is what we're talking about. I was wondering what Mario
ended up with. 377 million globally, it says, for Mario Brothers.
Yeah, so quite a big thing to happen.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, it's kind of one of those things, like, I don't know, Jonathan, I remember when your kids were little, they used to watch Minecraft YouTube videos all the time. It used to drive us crazy.
But yes, it did.
Yeah. So it's a thing. I mean, and you know, those kids are now, you know, 18, 19, 20, you know.
I was surprised that I was talking with my daughter the week before the movie came out, and she said, "What do you think about a Minecraft movie?" And I said, "Well, I'll be honest, I'm not a Minecraft fan. And when I looked at the trailer, it didn't do anything for me at all." And I said, "What about you? You're a huge Minecraft fan." She said, "I'll be honest, it looks kind of funny. It looks like they kind of get it." And I was like, "Really?" And she said, "Yeah, I would go see that if it's playing here in town." And I thought, okay, well, I'll keep that in mind. And it sold out, like, all last weekend. Every show was sold out
in New Brunswick at the Atlantic Theater.
At the Atlantic Theater here in Woodstock, which is admittedly a small theater, and it's in a small town. But that was my first clue. So when Jaime posted this story, I wasn't really that surprised, given that, like, there seemed to be a real fervor around here. I mean, don't forget that, you know, obviously it doesn't have the legs of you know, Mario or Sonic as far as how long those characters have been around. But Minecraft is, you know, more than two decades
old. It's a phenomenon, yeah.
And it is the best-selling game of all time. So most people of a certain age, probably under the age of 30, have played it. So, yeah, I mean, they clearly have tapped into something here, which is really, again, I don't get it. And I tagged onto your story here. I added on that little piece at the bottom there, which is these crazy fan reactions. Apparently, there's certain things that are like triggering these extreme fan reactions in the theater when certain scenes come up. There's a scene involving
positively,
but like apparently when they say a certain phrase, and again, I'm not a Minecraft fan, so I'm not sure I get it, but there is a scene that apparently when it happens in the movie, like all these Minecraft fans are standing up and they're jumping up and down and they're throwing popcorn and they're just like super, you know, over the top celebrating it, to the point where like they are asking like patrons to leave the theaters and it's creating a huge mess. But it's not like they are, you know, it's not like 1977 post, you know, in punk in
England. It's like the Rocky Horror Picture
Show. That's what it is. Right? It's done out of like, that's our thing. They're doing our thing. Let's all be silly.
Yeah, and like I saw the Rocky Horror Picture Show before it got crazy, but when I did see it, people were still saying spill it, and a few people brought toast
great
to the
Scott.
And threw it at, yeah, exactly, all that kind of stuff. But like now it's just like you got to wear like a poncho to keep yourself dry in the showing of that. Anyway,
yeah,
sorry.
But yeah,
just for context,
it's a big thing. It's a big thing. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see where this, you know, this is the biggest opening ever. Jaime, are you going to keep track of this for us and see where it ends up on the long list?
Yeah, I'll keep an eye out for this because, you know, I saw that initial trailer, like a lot of folks in the interwebs, I thought it kind of looks like trash, and I was outside of the Minecraft generation. I never really, I mean, I dabbled a bit, but never actually really got into it. It didn't speak to me there, but clearly it has hit the mark. And it will be interesting to see, you know, does it have legs to go beyond what's like Super Mario Brothers did with like $1 billion total box office when it finished its run in the theaters.
Yeah.
There's been a huge press tour on this. I saw interviews with Jason Momoa and Jack Black. And of course, Jack Black hosted Saturday Night Live last weekend, right? So yeah, it's they put a lot of juice behind this, and you know, you're kind of thinking, okay, well, how does Jason Momoa fit into this movie? And then you see the trailer, or you see the clips that he's in. They're making a story around it, because like it's like I'm thinking too. Yeah, it's a video game where you dig and you move blocks around. I mean, how do you make that into a movie? But apparently they did, right? So Jaime's going to tell us about how Tron Liberation Day is going to work.
I was going to go with, you know, it's Tronning time. Just kind of continue that meme, because if you don't know, we have the trailer here in the show notes for those of you transporting home for Tron Ares, starring Mr. Jared Leto. So
and the voice of Jeff Bridges. Yeah.
And the voice of Jeff Bridges. We didn't see him. Yeah, I'll be honest, I kind of forgot what happened to him at the end of Tron Legacy, because it's been 15 years. I'm going to have to, you know, watch
Has
a recap.
Has it been that long? What?
Wasn't it 2010? It was 2010, right? Does it say in the article?
Wow, okay.
Yeah, crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Still 15 not years. As far as the distance between the original and that one either, so.
Yeah. Madness, though.
Still. Yeah, yeah. So this one is kind of like, I guess, semi-spoilers for later seasons of Westworld, where it's like, hey, instead of people being digitized and being sent into the computer, the video game, if you recall, at the very tail end, Jeff Bridges' son and Olivia Wilde's character, who was a digital creation, she comes into the real world. And apparently the same thing is happening, where the red cycles, the red people, the red digital folks are coming into the real world and causing a lot of chaos in this trip.
Yeah. Causes chaos and unites everybody. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it sounds great. The Nine Inch Nails soundtrack is pretty dope after the Daft Punk soundtrack on the last movie.
Well, and Trent Reznor and his partner, don't they? They've like won Academy Awards and stuff, haven't they?
They have. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've done a lot of movie soundtracks the last little while. But this one's explicitly, I mean, obviously Atticus is part of Nine Inch Nails too, but it does explicitly say not just the two of them, but the whole band. So interesting.
Okay. Well, there's an actual band behind Nine. I've always wondered if it's Nine Inch Nails is just Trent Reznor and studio effects like Moby or Beck, right?
It was in the beginning. Like, he kind of did his own thing when it was first a project, but then quickly he has like a band that he works with and stuff. So. And yeah, Atticus is part of the band.
So I have a copy of this movie, next movie, on my phone at all times.
Yeah, but when was the last time you saw it in the theater? So the British Film Institute is doing a public screening of the original cut of Star Wars, no second title, for the first time in many decades. This was interesting because, you know, famously, as of the early 2000s, all media going forward from there is all the special editions, changed editions, new editions. And even before that, there were changes. Admittedly, they were minor, you know, up until the 90s. But even changing the name of the movie and the original Star Wars movie, it was just called Star Wars when it first came out. And then it was, you know, closer to when Empire came out that they added the New Hope part of that. A New Hope part of that. And yeah, so it's really interesting. And so the British Film Institute says that it is going to be doing its second annual Film on Film Festival. And that is about the celebration of the medium of print film. And so they are going to hold the first public screening of one of the handful of remaining dye transfer IB Technicolor prints made for Star Wars original release in the UK in December 1977, and it has been kept for preservation. So they're going to get it out of mothballs, and they're going to hold it at the opening night of this festival, which is June 12th in England. So, I mean, is it that hard to make this available? Like, I love that they're doing this, and I'm not going to fly to England to see it, but is it that hard? Like, should this be this precious? I must admit, when I saw this story, I was like, both, hey, that's cool. And I mean, Tim, you and I went a number of years ago. Your friend George invited us to see a screening of Clerks, right. An original film print of Clerks in the theater, which was a really interesting experience. Neither one of us had, I think, at that point seen it on a screen. And it was very different because it wasn't all color corrected and it wasn't all temperature corrected. It felt like a much more like a real raw indie film kind of.
It was like being at this film festival when they presented it for the first time kind of thing.
Yeah,
like,
and I thought like that was a really interesting experience. And I think there is something to be said. I actually really like the notion of this festival, the idea of showing film on film and getting to enjoy, you know, even the flaws in these things, but getting to enjoy it as it was originally presented, as opposed to, you know, color corrected and changed and all these different factors. But it did make me think as I was reading this, that as much as I would like to see this again on a big screen, I'd really just think it's absurd at this point. You know, like, are we just waiting for George to pass? Is that really what we're is that really where we're at? Like, is that what this is? We're waiting for him to die before we can get a proper digital release of the original cut of the movie and also that terrible, terrible, but yet incredibly rewatchable holiday special? Like,
yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, so I do go out of my way. I'm a TIFF member, and I do go out of my way to go see cuts of movies on film, like celluloid film, as well as digital, I guess. I mean, I went and saw Shaun of the Dead, a screening of that where I'm drawing a blank on the director's name.
Edgar Wright.
Yeah, he came out and did a talk just before. I've seen, you know, I saw... I had never seen Time Bandits in the theater, and I'd never seen Brazil in the theater. And those are two of my favorite movies. And whenever a new Terry Gilliam movie comes out, I make a point of going and see them. So I've seen the last, you know, three or four movies in the theater. Like, I saw the Zero Serum, and I saw the Don Quixote movie in the theater. I've seen like concert films in the theater. I did go and see, like, I think I told you guys, I had never seen Return of the Jedi in a screening. I went and saw that. I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark. I saw that last couple of years ago, right? So, but again, I've argued this many, many times. That's part of the reason why I keep this copy on my phone is this was the movie that, you know, kind of started for me. I was like Eric in the 70s show in 1977, having gone and seen this with my girlfriend on the weekend, and then spent the rest of the weekend trying to convince my other friends to go see it. Mm-hmm. And I saw it at the Uptown Theater and all that kind of stuff, right? So, which is now a condo. Oh, it's like a, so no, it's a furniture store or something. I went by the other day. I was just there the other day. Ugh. But just sitting in front of it going, I remember when that was a theater. But yeah, I mean, and again, like, it's sort of, and my problem with George Lucas has and his machinations is that I appreciate the original version of this film. I don't know if you remember too, but when you know, Return of the Jedi has all of that in your face, X-wings and mm-hmm. Rebel fighters flying towards the screen, and you could see when they transferred it over to VHS, you could see the mats on as they were, like, each TIE fighter had like a little square mat, yep. And you could see the edges, 100%. Right? Yeah, but because when it was projected in a dark theater, you never saw that.
Yeah.
Right? And that was part of the medium, right? And then, of course they had to clean it up, and they, I don't get me wrong, I'm completely appreciative of cleaning up film, or we're going to talk about resing film up in a few minutes, but like one of my favorite movies is For All Mankind, which was shot in 16mm film by the astronauts who are not directors of photography, right? And one of the things that they did recently was they had made a VHS copy of it, which I own, and then they made a DVD copy of it, which I own, and then they made a Criterion Blu-ray, which I also own, and I also own it in iTunes. But for the Blu-ray Criterion thing, they went and got the film out of the print out of storage. It was like they freeze film to keep it, preserve it, right? They thawed it out. They went frame by frame and they scanned each one and they retouched it for color, right? And then they made this Blu-ray. So I've got, like, a for the medium, a good copy. But they didn't change the content. I mean, they didn't superimpose A New Hope in below where it starts. Says Star Wars. Like, for me, I remember seeing Star Wars and then Episode 4, and I got the joke. Like, you didn't need to explain to me that it was meant to be a reel that was just sort of found. And I can't tell you the number of times I went to the theater when I was a kid to see a serial movie, to walk in on Episode 4 and, kind of wonder what Episode 1, 2, and 3 were all about, right? Sort of thing, right? So, yeah, I mean, I'd love to see this in the theater. I'm not going to fly to UK to do it, but, and I know people who would, but yeah.
And it's a funny thing, Tim, because I think the other thing about this is that I actually agree now.
Like, I'm also wearing a Star Wars t-shirt today, just so you know.
If I was going to show this to a young person, I probably, and I had the choice, I probably wouldn't want to show them the original 77 cut, because it is pretty rough in spots. I don't think that it necessarily, one negates the other. I think it's just, it comes down to choice. Why not let the consumers choose? In this case, we're letting the artists choose, or in this case, we're letting a giant faceless corporation choose. And again, maybe that was part of the deal in purchase, that they're not allowed to release this, or who knows what. But I think that's really what it comes down to, is I don't dislike all parts of the special editions. I think there's some terrific additions in there. Some of it's superfluous. The Jabba scene's pretty rough. And if anybody is on board with the Darth Vader screaming no thing that they added in a number of years ago at the end of Return, I think they need a head examined.
When does he say no?
Well, now they added it in, so... It's supposed to parallel the scene.
Is it when Luke throws him into the...
It's when he throws the... When the Emperor is shocking Luke, he looks and he starts first, he says, no. And then he goes, no.
Oh, so Darth Vader throws the Emperor over the
yeah, yeah.
Edge,
yeah,
right? Yeah. Oh, okay.
So, but while he's doing that, he's yelling, no, and it's brutal. I don't like that. But I do think that I understand, you know, artistic vision, fine, but give people the choice. I feel like we've had this conversation a few times before, but damn, it just, every time this thing comes up, I'm like, damn it, why not?
It's like when you guys went and saw the Back to the Future trilogy, right?
Sure
like
did.
It was, I think, and it was like all you sat there and watched all three of them, whatever.
You certainly did.
I don't think I made it there on time or something, but I think film as film needs to be preserved and respected and honored and seen like that. I mean, like, essentially. I don't know if they've ever made celluloid copies of the new improved, you know, I don't know how many iterations we've got of Star Wars at this point, but I don't know if those last, well, mind you, I did see the Return of the Jedi. I saw was the 97 cut, I guess, when they went and did they had a New Hope, a new version of A New Hope. They had, you know, I saw that one. Because I saw that one in Vancouver, and I saw the Empire Strikes Back here, right? And then in Toronto. And then a couple of years ago, I went and saw the Return of the Jedi for the first time on film in a theater, right? For all it's worth, I mean, sometimes the sound is horrible. And actually, speaking of which, I think we missed it, but there was a screening of Blade Runner, the final cut, at a theater called, I think, Paradise Theater, somewhere on the other side of Toronto, on the east end of Toronto, or west end of Toronto. I would have gone to see if I had figured it out and gotten the time and whatever. But that's, again, I saw that cut at a theater up on Mount Pleasant, about 10 years ago now, I guess, right? I think that people should, like you said, have the choice to go and see a film in the theater as, you know, theoretically were intended to be created, right? So, you know, so I 100% agree that people should have the choice to do it.
I mean, you're a little bit younger than both of us. Do you have a particular affection or interest in this horse race?
I didn't see the original that Tim is referring to. It was always, as far as I can recall, A New Hope on VHS for me, right, when I started watching this. So pre-special edition versions. And I was a teenager when the special editions came out, so I enjoyed going and seeing that. It was like such a cool vibe to you know, enjoy in the moment. Nowadays, I'm like, yeah, I kind of really don't read the special edition stuff. I kind of prefer this version. And my take on what you all are saying is, like, I'm totally fine with this stuff being presented and everything, this cool one-off, but really, this should all be on Disney Plus. Like, you should be able to, just like you can choose, like, I want to listen to this, you know, in French or Korean or something. Like, I want to be able to see the original version, the next iteration. Like, there's no, what, the cloud storage is too expensive? You can't give us options to choose?
That said, I have a, talk about it in this article, I think it was, when they talk about these ones. So I actually have a DVD that came with a comic book of A New Hope, and it's got the new version of A New Hope on one disc, and it's got this original cut, the 77 cut, on the other disc. So I've got this, because they did release the original Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi as part of that DVD package, right? So it was possible, or it is possible, to kind of sort of own it, right? I keep, every now and then I look on eBay to see if I can get like Empire Strikes Back or Return of the Jedi in that format, because it's cool to see to have the original and be able to watch it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But 2006, it says here, right? Yeah. There was a 2006 of both versions, of the 2004 version and the original cut versions of all the first trilogy. And of course the Laserdisc, but we all threw our Laserdiscs away, right?
Yeah.
Never had a Laserdisc, by the way.
I remember watching Star Wars A New Hope on Laserdisc during one of those like teacher in-service kind of days, or maybe it was a substitute teacher for a few days because your teacher has the flu or something, you know, keep you busy during class.
Well, it says here that in the end of the article, it says that the original cut of Star Wars was made available for streaming last month on Roku.
Yeah, it was up briefly, but they, again, this was I think it was a fan made reassembled cut.
Oh, yeah, gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Well, stay tuned, folks. The fight continues.
Is it a fight?
I have no, because we've lost. We have no say in it. We just scream into the wind.
Well, who knows? Maybe Tiff. Well, mind you, they're saying this is an original copy that they're going to show, right?
Yep.
Original print.
Which is hilarious. Like, I remember being a child, and from the public library, you could rent 35 millimeter films and a projector. And so for like kids' birthdays and stuff, they would like set up a screen and you could watch these movies in your home. And I distinctly remember us getting Star Wars 1 year when I couldn't have been like 6, 7. So very early 80s. I remember it being a thing.
Your mom says it was great for babysitting. She would just pack a bunch of kids in the car, take them over and...
Oh, I mean, when I was a kid, they used to play like matinees, and matinees were like $2. And, you know, my mom would just drop me off with a baggie of popcorn and a can of pop and say, I'm going fabric shopping. I'll see you in 4 hours. And I'd be like, cool. I get to sit and watch Star Wars.
You were 13 at the time, right? You were 13 at the time. Let's get this. Listen to me. You were 13.
Not at all. Not even close.
It wasn't child abandonment at all.
I think I started seeing movies by myself when I was 6.
I used to go to theaters too when I was young.
Like, and all kids did. Like, it didn't matter. The theaters were all just full of kids. But it was definitely a thing.
Yeah, the boogeyman was just a theory, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is where we've lost Jaime. He's like, no, probably stranger danger, stranger danger.
Don't get in the van.
There we go.
I've got a cut of Star Wars in my van.
That's right. Hey, kids, you want to go to the drive-in and see the Star Wars? Yes, I do.
Sorry, Jaime, we stole that's JPK. We stole your story.
No, this
back
is...
Back to Jaime.
This is great because you were talking about predators, and here, what a great segue to the next edition in the Predator film series. Although, this one is in...
It's in Predator milieu.
apparently, it's in the broader universe, but not, strictly part of... everything else canonically. It's a standalone project called Predator Killer of Killers, coming out on Hulu, very similar to how Hulu previously
had. Is it a game or a movie?
I understand your confusion, and this is great because this is an audio only medium. So this is a 3D animated anthology film. So think of it as like the Animatrix, for example. One film, okay. So not a series. People were confused about that. Not a series. It's one film with different stories underneath.
I think probably says most deadly game in new trailer. Phrase
hunting humans, right? That's the most.
Yeah, no, I get the game. Game hunting, yes.
So 3D animated hunting humans, the most dangerous game in the Viking era, samurai, World War II pilots.
Mm, yeah, true. Yeah. So, since it's the movie I was talking about last week was 2018, I didn't sort of give it away, but they find out that the predators are enhancing themselves by genetically, so they become super warriors, right? And that's the MacGuffin in this new movie, in the Predator from 2018, right? I was also thinking about the parallels. It was because it was a ragtag bunch of army guys in the first Predator movie with Schwarzenegger, right?
I mean, they weren't ragtag. They were tougher than a bag full of nails for all the good.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But like these guys in this movie, like I said, they're a bunch of has-beens and screw-ups. There's basically screw-ups. And what it is the main character finds proof of this thing, and it's sort of like a government cover-up. And then to get him out of the way, they send him into this, off to be, to put into jail or whatever where they were going, right? So that's the setup, right? Yeah, and it puts some humor into the movie as well.
I like a good anthology movie. I have always had it. I think Heavy Metal was the one that first sort of clicked me into like the fun of that one. Was cool because it was like the magazine. It was like not just different stories, but different art styles, right? Like,
and different takes. Yeah.
I think that's why that Star Wars Visionaries series kind of caught my eye, was the different. First, it was the Japanese studios, and then it was the worldwide studios in the second season. I thought that was really neat.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was like Mad Magazine was sort of the.
Oh, yeah. Same thing.
So Mad Magazine had a group of artists who brought different themes and different styles. And then I think Heavy Metal, and it was another one too I used to read in like those are the books I read at the time, but when I was a teenager, that had, and they would tell you various sci-fi stories through, sometimes with no words, like Mobius was famous for doing stories with no words.
Yep. Right? Yeah. Blueberry.
Yeah. Yep. Cool. It does look like it blows up real good, but you know, it's, again, it's like you guys are more into the anime than, or that style than I would be, right? So
yeah, it does. It looks pretty dope. Like,
stay tuned, kids. Yeah. Stay tuned. Speaking of Jack Black,
in the in the grand tradition of British shows coming across the pond to America, The Office, for example, I guess there's sharing and sharing alike. So if you all are familiar with Saturday Night Live, or SNL, as the cool kids call it, apparently they're going to do a British version of that. Still overseen by Lorne Michaels, so you can still do your Dr. Evil impression if you'd like. It'll be using local to the UK comedians to do that. So thoughts, gentlemen, on this?
Yeah, it's interesting that we call it Saturday Night Live, or it's called Saturday Night Live now, because it was written, and they still say live from New York, it's Saturday night.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They don't say live, right? And so what, I don't know if it's going to be like live from London, it's Saturday night, or live from Birmingham, it's Saturday night. I don't know how they're going to do that.
Yeah, I think just recently, because of the anniversary, they showed the first episode, and in the first one they say it's NBC's Saturday night. Which is
on the British version?
No, on the American one, the one that they showed the first episode with Carlin and all that.
When they finish
the cold open, they say, live from New York, it's Saturday night, and then broadcaster comes on to sort of talk about, what's on the show. He says, it's NBC's Saturday night. And
Don Pardo.
Don Pardo. Exactly. It was interesting. I don't know if I think this is in any way necessary. Maybe it will be good, but I watch a lot, especially on YouTube. I watch a lot of British comedy chat show stuff, and just like Q, and just some of the weird stuff that is done in British comedy, Taskmaster. Like, there's so many great British comedians.
What's the one where they do the math problems with
what's that one called? Countdown.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many great British comedians, and there's so many great British shows that highlight those comedians. Maybe there's a whole generation that we're waiting to discover that this show will bring to light, but also I like that British stuff doesn't need to do America. Like, I kind of like Britain doing Britain in the same way I like Canada doing Canada, and I like America for doing America. I think SNL is so intertwined with New York City. It feels very strange to the idea of it not being that.
Well, like, it's interesting, and I wonder how Jaime feels about this, but I remember when I moved to Vancouver in the 90s, having grown up with Saturday Night Live being on at 11:30 every, Saturday night. In Vancouver, it's broadcast at 12, midnight. So, first of all, you already know it's delayed, right? And then it's delayed a half an hour, and they had some other Vancouver local show on before it. So it was very strange to watch. At the time, this is way before YouTube, obviously, but this changed to watch Saturday Night Live, not live.
Well, but so much of it now, like, I have so many friends. Like, I still watch it in the moment sometimes.
Yeah.
Often I PVR it and I watch it on Sundays. But like so many people, I watch a lot of it on social media.
I was tuned like 10 after 12 around that time when Colin Jost and Michael Che are on. And I tune into that because it's puts a cap on the week, right?
Yeah. And again, depending on who the guest is, depending on the musical guest, sure, I'm into it. I think that's the part that maybe I'd be most excited about a UK edition of Saturday Night is
seeing British bands. Yeah,
to see more British bands, because there's a lot of up and coming British bands that I'm into. So maybe there's a chance for some of those smaller, lesser known, especially internationally, artists to get a little prime time.
Yeah, and the hosts theoretically are going to be, centered around British movies and TV and stuff like that, right? You would think.
Yeah.
Mind you, they'll probably bring some Americans over. Like, that other Graham Norton show is a good show because he has a mix of UK and North American stars, right, on that show.
Jaime, are you staying up Saturday nights? Jaime, are you staying up? Let's see, how many hours difference is there between Seattle and...
Do you see it at 8 o'clock at night, or do you see it at like...
Yeah, for Saturday Night Live, it comes out here at like 8:30 p.m. local time.
Oh, it does come live. Okay. All right.
So if that was being shot in UK, tack another 5 hours onto that.
But so, they're ahead of me by 8 hours.
I mean, it'd be 5 hours before that. So you'd be watching it at 3:30 in the afternoon.
Saturday night in London.
Yeah. That might not be quite as magical.
I mean, having, you know, watched the show and listened to people being on the show, and it's an interesting format that, you know, they spend a ton of time and a lot of energy. Like, you talk to cast members who are currently on the show, or you see them on interviews and stuff like that. Their heads are spinning every week, right? It's a very strange format show, right, from that point of view. In that it's basically they start on, you know, Tuesday, and you know, the art musical guest comes in on Friday and does their sound checks, and you know, yeah, and then. I mean, that's why it was amazing that Jack White was able to step in and during the COVID time and replace that one country singer, right? That he was able to pull that off, you know, in a mere hours, right?
Well, I mean, again, that's exactly what we're just talking about, though. That's New York, right? Like,
yeah.
A, it's probably one of the easiest places on the planet to get a flight to from anywhere.
Yeah, that's true.
And
true.
B, it's also a place where dozens, hundreds, thousands of, you know, highly talented individuals live and work, right? So
yeah, and they've got that whole Broadway and the off-Broadway kind of mentality, right? Like, those people are doing this every week kind of thing, right? They're used to that kind of grind, right? And mind you, London has its West End, and they have a whole theater thing, and maybe that's part of it. And I don't know that they have, like, Second City. I don't know if they have a Second City out there in the UK, or fans can let us know, right? Because Second City in Toronto and Chicago are kind of where a lot of the original people from and the current people came from to get on the show, right?
Yeah. All right. What else you got for us, Jaime?
In this AI-enabled time, and in a time in which the Las Vegas Sphere, the giant sphere that they have there, you know, they did like U2 and everything, and they've given concerts and everything. It's this like immersive thing. I've not been there myself. I've only seen, you know, the live streams that people do from being in there. It's kind of like being like in the dome part of the planetarium, right? Is how I kind of envision it. And like you're there and you're seeing all the cool stuff. Well, the nice people at Google have worked with the nice folks over at, who is it, MGM that owns?
Yep.
I'm going to say it's MGM that owns Wizard of Oz.
And therefore, it's actually Amazon. Because Amazon bought MGM.
That's true. So interesting there. But they're enhancing The Wizard of Oz to make it viewable and much more immersive in the Las Vegas sphere. So this article mentions they're increasing the film's resolution, extending footage, and then adding characters to scenes to increase the immersion, according to this article from The Verge. So, you know, in a certain camera shot, like, okay, cool, I can't see, you know, the uncle because he would be off screen. Well, that would feel kind of weird of like, where did he go? He just disappear. Object permanence. So they have used AI to have that actor there. So you could kind of turn to the side and see him.
Oh, you mean they've modified. Yeah, it's funny because I think I mentioned I saw the first of the what do we call the new Star Treks?
The Kelvins.
The J.J. Abrams.
Yeah.
Kelvins. So I saw the first Kelvin one at the Cinesphere Dome at the Science Center, right? And you're almost lying on your back. You're looking up at this screen, and you have to turn your head completely to the left to see one speaker, and then turn your head completely to the right to see the other speaker because of the curved screen, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas normally a flat screen would be right in front of you. You'd be able to just, you know, like a tennis ball, move back and forth, right? Yeah, so I mean, I'm not opposed to that. It sounds really interesting to sort of see a movie that way. I don't know, but like, are they like the YouTube tickets? Are they like $1,000 a seat kind of thing? Or
good question. I don't know. With Vegas, it can kind of go one of those two ways. It's either relatively dirt cheap because they're going to just crank out a whole bunch of people going through that as fast as they can, or it could be a premium experience that's like $1,000 per seat, like you mentioned.
Well, it says 16,000 pixel by 16,000 pixel screen. So
yeah,
clearly they had to res it up.
I, When I saw this article, what I thought of was, Tim, do you remember going and seeing the first Shazam movie? It was the first time you and I went to go, and I think maybe the only time that I've gone, probably the only time you've gone, to go see that. What do they call it?
Yeah, they put the light on the side of the theater.
They basically extend the screen down the walls, the side of the walls of the theater. I cannot remember.
But it's not real. It's just color. Yeah.
It added a level of immersion, but there was really never anything good on the sides. Like, it was always just like more sky, more ground, more fire.
I don't know if you remember, but they showed a lead into it,
which was way better than the movie.
Yeah, it was better than the movie. Better effect. Yeah, for sure.
But that's what I was reminded of when I heard this. I thought that's what it sounds like. Is are they adding value or are they adding stuff? Because I don't need stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of seeing the off-screen character is like, okay, you know, I guess it feels like you're there, like some of the Vision Pro stuff that Tim has talked about. And I think the stuff that would feel kind of more interesting to me is kind of logical things, like when they go into the big, poppy field or something that makes them sleepy. It's like, oh, that would be kind of cool to feel like you're in the field because you're completely surrounded by poppies, most of which were never filmed, and they're just AI generated to fill in the rest of the sphere. So it might work better for that. No word yet if they've replaced all the shotguns with walkie-talkies and other stuff we might expect as they tinker with this.
ScreenX, it's called ScreenX.
ScreenX, there you go.
You can go see Minecraft, a Minecraft movie in ScreenX at the Scotiabank.
More squares. Woo.
But it's interesting because it does fill your peripheral. I mean, that's the idea behind it, right? It doesn't put any actual footage there. It just shows color.
Cool.
I'm interested to see. I'm waiting for a price drop, but they made a version of Wizard of Oz in 3D available for Vision Pro. And I'm waiting for the price to drop because I don't want to pay a lot of money to see a movie I've seen 1,000 times, you know?
Yeah.
But I might rent it. I don't know.
So I'm going to read the title here, and then I'm going to give you the positive take and then cynical take. The title here is Stunts Are Finally Getting Their Own Category at the Oscars.
Just in time for Tom Cruise to retire.
Well, there you go, right into the positive take and negative take. Positive take is like, wow, it's great that they're honoring, more people, a lot of people that are kind of unsung heroes. And it's like, I kind of wonder if Tom Cruise is going to win this one and completely trash the entire idea of expanding the possible set of people getting their honors. Not to discredit the work that he does. Every time I see a movie trailer with him, I'm like, I wonder if that's CGI or if he really did it, which I would never wonder with anybody else, right?
It would always be CGI. A lot of times he does it. It's crazy.
There's like a non-zero chance that it's him. I'm like, ooh, tell me more. Whereas other people are like, it's The Rock not doing that. He's not on the outside of an airplane, but Tom Cruise totally is.
Yeah, well, it's like that. The was it Mission Impossible Fallout where he jumps from one building to the other and breaks his ankle as he's hits the wall and then gets up and starts running. Every time I watch that scene, I'm like, I know he broke his ankle, and I know I'm watching a man trash his ankle for real. Right? My concern about my negative take about this. Okay, so this is like the old question is, should they let Olympic athletes take steroids? Right. I mean, where does it stop is my concern. Like, what happens now? Like, what are these guys going to do to win the Oscar, I mean, like the guy in Raiders of the Lost Ark who gets dragged behind the
truck,
the truck with just a piece of leather on his back or whatever. Mm-hmm.
I go back to, sorry, Tim, I go back to one of my very favorite comedians is the late Bill Hicks. And he had a whole stand-up bit about, and maybe we could link it into the show notes, but he had a great bit about how he went and saw, Bill died back in the 90s, it's been gone a long time, but he did a whole bit about how good the special effects were in Terminator 2. And he's like, I don't know how you top that. He's like, actually, you know what you do is you need to get sick people and old people and pay them enough money that they'll do the stunts in movies. And if they get their head kicked off, they get their head kicked off. And he's like, hey, grandma, do you want to be in the new Chuck Norris movie? Oh my God, he kicked her head clean off.
But there, I mean, there have been movies too. I can't remember if it was like Saving Private Ryan or other movies where they have actual warfare and they've used amputees to sort of play the.
Oh yeah, well they did that in the Lord of the Rings.
No,
it was Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones had an open casting call for people who had missing limbs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because they were going to do a scene where people got like delimbed, and they basically said, "You not only do you have to be a person without like really who does not have certain limbs, but you have to be okay with us then proceeding to chop off those limbs." Because really, those are two separate issues, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, there's also that phantom limb thing. I don't know if you guys know about that, but
yeah, phantom limb syndrome.
You can trick somebody into thinking, even if they don't like, you can. You can injure a pretend version of somebody's hand. If you convince them it's their hand, they'll actually scream out in pain, right? And then people who have had their limbs, who've lost limbs, have said they can still feel. They get their limb gets itchy. They're, you know, like because it's
a phantom limb, right? On. That's the whole idea of a phantom limb.
Anyway, that's my concern. Is just like how, I mean, first of all, how far will Tom Cruise go? We're about to find out. And then, you know, when does it end, right?
Yeah,
that might, I mean, I get it. Like that said, too. I mean, like, what was it? Somebody won. Was it Brad Pitt won an Academy Award for playing a stuntman just recently?
Yeah,
2 years ago, and he said he basically said thank you to every single stunt person who came before him. Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some incredible stunt work over the years, and like we obviously appreciate it because we tend to watch a lot of genre things that have really cool special effects and stunts and stuff like that. Yeah, like these people, I think, are worthy, are doing performances that are as valuable to the films as the acting at times, especially in some of these sort of, you know, stunt and action spectaculars that are really not about the plot. So yeah, why not? Why not? Like, give these people an award. Give them two.
Yeah.
What are they going to do when it's all men that win these awards the first little while? That'll suck.
I don't know. Can't say. But you know what? That brings us to the main part of the show where we talk about something, this time Star Trek related, thanks to our friend Keen, has put us with the idea of doing Star Trek the Animated Series. So we're going to do a couple of episodes this week, and then we're going to get back into some more sci-fi, and then we'll come back to the animated series for the rest of the run. So this week we're doing the animated series season 1 episode 1 and season 1 episode 2, Beyond the Farther Star and Yesteryear. And the first thing I noticed about this, if I can start, is it was in 4x3 format. It hadn't been in letterbox. And the second thing I thought was super cool is the second episode written by DC Fontana.
Yeah, right? It sure was.
Yeah. So anyway, you guys can go ahead. I mean, I've been watching this since I was like, you know, 13 or something, but what did you think?
Yeah, bringing this in because I want to make sure I don't forget about the Slack discussion. I went into this, right? Fully expecting to dunk on it, just fully expecting to dunk. And I realized after watching the first couple episodes, it's like, you know what? This is 1960s Star Trek ... but animated. It's like the same kinds of plots. It's literally the same people, the same actors, now as voice actors. And so there's pros and cons to that, right? I think my significant other, you know, she kind of overheard. She's like, are you watching some 1940s show? I'm like, no, you're not that far off, really. It's much slower paced. These are only, you know, 20-ish minute episodes. So they do go a little faster than a 1960s episode. But I'm like, it's very faithful, right? It's very faithful to Star Trek, the 1960s show. So if you enjoy that, you're going to enjoy these, I think. If you don't enjoy that, this probably isn't for you. Like, that's how closely intertwined they were in my head.
Yeah, and I think from an animation point of view, I look at them from the point of view, again, of its time. This was what animation was like in the 70s on TV. You had the Flintstones.
This is what it was like right up until like the mid 80s. Like this was.
Yeah. It's repetitive. Like watch the show and I'm going to spoil it for you, but their chins never move.
Yeah, just their mouths.
Right. Yeah. Just their mouths. Right. And you know, like Fred Flintstone used to run across the living room and he would pass the same window six times, you know. that's the kind of quality we're talking about. We're not talking about, you know, Princess Mononoke or you know, some of the like the even yeah, the
it's,
Predator.
It's not
animation.
Miyazaki. It's not yeah, it's not high right. art. Yeah.
No, but it is of its time. And like I said, that theme music, that stress music, oh, every time I hear it, I'm like.
Yeah, my first two thoughts were, one, this is one of the worst theme songs.
Oh, yeah. Why did they change the theme song?
Like, what a waste. Like, you're only a few years removed from the original series with this timeless, incredible Alexander Courage soundtrack. Why change that? Because I found this was a little flat to the point where my wife said, like, why does this theme song suck so much? I was like, yeah, well, okay.
It's like what they do these days when they change, like a couple of TV or people I watch on, podcasts I listen to where they don't have the rights to play the actual music, so they play sound-alike music.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it sounds like Star Trek's theaters, or Alexander Courage music, but it's not.
Yeah.
And you're right, of all the Star Trek themes out there, this is definitely the worst.
And again, like, especially if, as you pointed out, Jaime, it's very faithful. It feels like an extension of the 1960s series. It really does feel like, you know, that series ended on a Tuesday and this picks you up on a Thursday. Like, it's just, it's right there. But the music kind of leaves you just a little bit not as hyped going into it. And the other thing that I really took away from this watching the first one, you know, it starts pretty abruptly. It just kind of jumps you right into what's happening, which is fine. But I found, like, through the first two episodes, it was just a smidge joyless. Which, again, I think speaks to its era, but I do also think that is kind of missing from the original series. If this is an adaptation or a follow-up piece to that, there was always, you know, a little more witty banter, you know, just Shatner's emotive face, the smirks and stuff.
Yeah, it was campy. It was smirk. There were a lot of smirky, tongue firmly planted in cheek stuff. And there was that triad. Like, we used to watch this the original series before Next Generation came on, mm-hmm. in reruns all the time, and mm-hmm. like in university and stuff. And it was like the triangle of relationships between Kirk, Spock, and McCoy.
Yep. That's what the heart of the show was the
guys
relationship
get in the room,
three.
You know, like, yeah. And what's amazing about this, though, when you think about it, if you know anything about history of Star Trek and the show, I'm amazed that they got William Shatner to come back for this. Cause at the time he was like, he wouldn't even go to the Comic Cons or whatever they were called. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. He was kind of starting to distance himself from this whole thing, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would say that the two stories actually had, like, you know, like, they're pretty solid. The first one is the, you know, they get sucked into this sort of, you know, vortex and, you know, an alien entity tries to take over the ship. And again, we always talk about that with Lower Decks, just sort of exploring these tropes. This one certainly is no, you know, stranger to a trope, but it's a successful telling of that. It was engaging and it was enjoyable. But like I say, it just seemed to be lacking a little bit of that charm that the first series had. A little bit of that just sort of whimsical kind of nature to it. The second one was a little bit better. There was a little bit, you know, at the end of the episode, they were making fun of, like, well, at least you're not an Andorian. Ha 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 ha. And I was like, okay. Yeah,
and in 1973 to be talking about like the butterfly effect, right?
Well, and they were talking about it was the first one where they were talking about, like, you know, like, they were not dumbing down their science. And that was the other thing that I thought was really interesting as far as a time capsule was, like, they wanted you to get a dictionary if you needed to, or a textbook. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think I might have mentioned it before, but one of my very favorite things I remember from my childhood was seeing an interview with Stan Lee. And I couldn't have been like 10 years old, but I remember seeing this interview with Stan where he said, I'm never going to talk down to people in my comic books. If a kid has to pick up a dictionary to learn a word, good. And I thought, God, that's such a beautiful way to put that. And I kind of felt that about this was like, they're not dumbing this down. Like, I think they kind of had a vibe that this wasn't necessarily just for kids, that this was also for the teenagers and 20 somethings and stoners who all, you know, were watching Star Trek at that point. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I was watching I used to watch Saturday morning cartoons, and then at noon on CBC, they would show the original series. Right. And I remember, I remember seeing it when I was like 6 or 7 when it first came out, because my dad came home from work saying, "We got to see this show," which is, he did that a lot. But so I watched this a lot, and then when this came out, I was like, yes, you know, totally. And I must have watched every single episode. I can't remember. It was like a long time ago, but I remember the stress music and I remember really enjoying this, but you're right. It does sort of have, there is a bit something missing. And I think that I get that sense too, right? That it's a little too serious in some cases, right?
Yeah.
What do you think, Jaime?
Yeah, there were some interesting choices in these first two episodes. So the first one, Beyond the Farthest Star, right? It's kind of like, I guess it's reverse because TNG comes out later. What's the name of the goo creature that kills Tasha Yar? Armus?
The pit guy, the black pit guy.
Yeah. Very similar thing where like danger, and they're like, okay, the result is they have to trick the creature and leave it alone. In this case, in the animated series, after they have tricked the creature to be stuck on that dead moon, it cries like, I don't want to be alone. Like that is a choice. Like, you didn't have to make that choice. It could have been like, oh wow, I'm sure glad it'll never hurt anybody again. We'll leave a buoy here so that a warning to people.
So lonely.
Yeah, it's like, that's such an interesting choice.
It's kind of dark. It really is.
Yeah.
Dark.
I guess similarly for episode 2, Yesteryear. The butterfly effect piece of changing where, you know, one, you know, Spock died as a kid. Hey, kiddos, hope you're paying attention when you're eating your Cheerios. This guy died as a kid, and now we got to go back in time to solve this. And the choice that his pet dies, the thing that did not happen in the original timeline. I'm like, that is a choice.
He talks about his pet in... what's the new one with
Strange New Worlds?
Strange New Worlds. He talks about that pet, right?
So
that's come full circle. That particular animal.
So it's really interesting. I don't know if it was like, "See, kids, you got to pay attention to your parents, otherwise you might, at worst, kill yourself accidentally and make it so you don't survive to adulthood, and at best, your beloved pet Rover will die."
I didn't remember Spock being bullied because he gets bullied in the Kelvin universe, right?
Right.
But I, you know, as a kid, I don't remember him being bullied by, I didn't remember it, but he's bullied in this one, right?
Mm-hmm.
By the Vulcans, pure Vulcans.
Yeah.
And not for the outfit that he was wearing, strangely.
Okay. The other note I had was, I cannot believe, and I looked this up on Memory Alpha, why don't we have Commander Thelen as like a character that comes out somewhere, like Strange New Worlds or something? So he was the guy who became the commander when Spock, you know, has died as a child.
The Andorian dude.
Yeah, the Andorian guy. I'm like, there's, you know, stuff in, you know, like novels and things. I'm like, this is a dude who needs to be in Strange New Worlds. It's probably too late for 3, season 4. There you go. Make it happen, folks.
And also, can we talk about the life support belts?
So those are great.
Those
hey, kind of, we don't want to have to animate spacesuits. Cool. Let's put belts on them.
Those feel like
a green glow.
Okay, so in the timeline, this takes place after Discovery and Strange New Worlds, right? So it seems to me, right? I'm trying to stitch together the lore. So there were definitely people who were pretty hurt about Star Trek Discovery having the Iron Man, you know, nanomachine style spacesuits that were the environmental suits they could use. The stuff that Kirk and crew have here, the life support boots, although out of universe, are probably to like save time and effort animating. they feel more advanced than what Michael Burnham would have used in the past. Like, that kind of tracks, right? It's less armor, I suppose, but it's less cumbersome. You can see without having like a blue light in your face. You don't have to worry about, you know, your breath fogging up the glass. So I think this is bringing it sort of full circle.
Yeah, it was funny, but it's interesting because, you know, I mean, the reason why they had those ethereal creatures in the original series is because of the budget, right? They didn't have Doctor Who money to make a little big furry monster animal, right, kind of thing all the time. So they would have like a video effect would be the villain, right? And so to animate a video effect was kind of ridiculous in the Beyond the First Further Star, and then. You know, and then, yeah, like the belts, that was hilarious, right? Pretty funny.
I also wondered which of these two things happened, that they spend all the money or have no money and pirate the Godzilla sound. Because, again, my significant other was not looking at the screen. She's like, are you watching Godzilla now? I said, no, that is 100% not Godzilla making the Godzilla sound.
What was the Godzilla sound?
It was the creature that attacks young Spock and his pet. In yesteryear.
Okay.
Yeah, it was making a screeching sound. It was clearly a roar screech that was clearly Godzilla's soundtrack.
Really?
Sound effect, yeah.
Well, maybe they spent all the money on the crew, on the cast, right?
I don't know. Did they? I don't think they made money back then. I think it was like, hey, here's a sandwich. And then show up yeah. to this recording studio.
Well, that's true. William Shatner used to be on a lot of shows back in the day. And all of them did, really, you know? Because Leonard Nimoy went to Mission Impossible. Mm.
Yeah, I must admit, I hadn't watched this in many, many, many years, and I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. And I'm actually kind of curious. Like, yeah, it's dated. There's no way around that. A lot of things are dated. If you know, again, this we're talking about a series that is 51, almost 52 years old. So sure, but yeah, I mean, if you like original Trek, I can see why this fit. You know, fit the bill for you for the short time in between, right?
Better than no track. It wasn't until like what 83 or 82 when you know, it would have been I think 84 when the Next Generation came out. 87. Wow.
Yep. So I remember I raced through my paper route that day so I could get home in time to watch it.
Yeah, we had a watching party. We had people come over and partake, and we watched it all together. We made it through the first season, though. That's a good thing, right?
Yeah. Speaking of things that haven't aged well.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you say, Keen? Do you dare us to watch that one too?
Don't go there. Yeah, I think if we do the Next Generation, can we just skip the first year?
No, we have to watch the terrible racist third episode.
Oh yeah. Is that the one where the women have to fight or something?
Yes, certainly is.
Yes. Okay.
There will be no vaccine.
Now, a word from our sponsor.
Many supplements on the market are hard to absorb or packed with fillers, but that's not the case with Quiksilver Scientific. Quiksilver Scientific is a U.S.-based company that manufactures advanced liposomal supplements, making nutrients easier for your body to absorb and put to work quickly. Made in Colorado in an NSF GMP certified facility and rigorously tested, this is science first supplementation. After adding ultravitamin into my routine, recovery feels faster and I don't hit that midday crash anymore. Trusted worldwide for supplements that truly make a difference in performance, resilience, and well-being. Quiksilver Scientific makes advanced liposomal supplements so you can actually feel the difference. Energy, focus, calm, recovery. Get 10% off plus free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. That's tryqs.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Now, back to the show.
Is ready to move on to Daredevil?
Yes.
Born Again? Season 1, Episode 8, Isle of Joy.
Penultimate episode of Season 1.
Ooh, penultimate. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a good point. Good point. Thought we dodged that bullet.
Well, unlike Matt.
Unlike Matt, who didn't dodge the bullet, yeah. I think it's interesting that he took the bullet.
Yeah. So, yeah, this was a pretty propulsive kind of story. I would say it definitely felt like we're kind of building towards the end, which was good. there was a lot of sort of threads from the season that kind of pulled together in this one in a good way, I think. It still feels a little uneven. This whole series just kind of feels just a smidge uneven. And again, maybe that's, we talked about, like, hey, maybe it's because they, you know, they started filming things and they started gluing things together. And sure, maybe that's the problem, but it still feels just a little bit kind of all over the place. But I think bringing back Bullseye was a strong start because that's an amazing character. And the actor who plays him is also really great.
I just want to ask, I did want to ask about the Bullseye thing. And well, maybe I'll bring this back as my big question, I guess. I'll hold it. I'll hold that thought.
All right. So, yeah, I mean, we get kind of all these different points of conflict for Matt. And it's at a point, it seems like he's just going to go squirrely, right? Because he, you know, he has this, you know, invitation to go meet Bullseye, who is the man who killed his best friend. He realizes that, you know, Fisk is, you know, manipulating his girlfriend, who basically says, like, Daredevil is no better than Muse. And then, yeah, he's basically got, like, all these things coming around, and it looks like, the world is basically at the feet of the Kingpin and his wife. And, you know, it kind of culminates with this scene where, you know, Bullseye is going to theoretically assassinate Fisk, and then Murdoch takes the bullet for him, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I thought he was going to take her out, because I thought she had put him up to that.
Yeah, well, and that's, I guess the question is, like, why is he doing that? Is Dex going after Fisk because he put him into Gen Pop? Is he putting him in because, you know, he knows stuff that needs to be silenced? Is he doing it because Vanessa hired him to do it? Like, what's the reasoning behind, like, Dex has his own code. He's twisted and monstrous, but he has his own code. I don't know. Jaime, what do you make of all this?
Yeah, I know they definitely hinted at one sort of interesting thing, because I was kind of curious about how things sort of play through there. It was pretty interesting to see Bullseye manipulate the situation so he could get injured and use that as a way to get out.
Well, that's my question, though. Did he do that, or did Matt injure him so he could get into the hospital?
I was under the impression that Matt just got mad, smashed his face into the table. In fact, that's my quote right there. Hey, guard, he started smashing his face on the table as a way to cover it up. And then, you know, immediately after Matt leaves, the Bullseye is like, hey, thank you so much, because now I have this broken tooth, or dislodged tooth that I can use as a little pew 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 to escape.
That's what I mean. Like, I kind of wondered, because he said, I can tell you the truth, but I have to be outside, right? And then that's around the time when Matt starts banging his head against the table, right? Mike, that's my question to you guys. Do you think Matt did that on purpose to get him out of jail, or get him out of the Gen Pop? And
I would have said yes. Initially, that was exactly what I thought, because, again, maybe I've read too many comic books. But
I went back and watched that scene again. That's how I went, wait a minute, and I went back and watched it again.
Yeah, when he slammed his face down and Dex said thanks, I knew exactly what was happening, because, like, this is something that Dex has done in the comic books. Like, he is, all he needs is a paper clip, a staple, a tooth, and he can kill you with it. So to me, it clicked in the moment. That's exactly what he was doing. But was he manipulating Matt, or was Matt giving him what he wanted because Matt also wanted that? And I would have said that that's exactly what happened until Matt stepped in front of that bullet. That, to me, didn't make a lot of sense. Like, why would you?
But wasn't he dancing with his girlfriend at the time? I mean, Kingpin, he was dancing with the doctor at that time, right?
He was. So I guess the theory is he wasn't trying to save Fisk. He was trying to save her.
Or he was just trying to, do something, right? It's interesting, too, that the one character sees him walking out of the bar without his cane.
Yeah. Yeah. He forgot his cane. Oh, I didn't notice.
Yeah. He didn't use his cane. Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing I was kind of wondering about is that very end where Matt takes the bullet. This was foreshadowed from earlier, where it was like, hey, you know, you're a hero if you can even, you know, save your adversaries, the villains. So it fits in with that. But I didn't 100% understand the motivation. I kept wanting to apply the Batman Begins motivation at the end, where Christian Bale's Batman is confronting Ra's al Ghul on the train, and Ra's is like, you know, you can't kill me, it's not in you. And he's like, well, I don't have to kill you, but I don't have to say you either. And whoop, peace out. It's like, he could have just, you know, not done anything and just let Fisk be taken out. I was like, oh, isn't that sad? Well, I wasn't the one who shot him. Can't give up my secret identity, sorry.
Yeah, and maybe that's an element of it, is this is Matt's way of sort of guaranteeing an amount of, you know, it would be pretty weird if Fisk made his life a living hell after he just jumped in front of a bullet for him, right? So, Yeah, I'm curious now. I must admit, I wasn't sure where they were going to try and land this plane in the final episode. This was a bit of a, you know, faster paced episode. We've had a few sort of slower burns, although, you know, the Muse stuff over the past few episodes has been interesting. I am kind of curious, knowing that they've already got a season waiting for next year of this series. I wonder,
already filmed or?
Yeah, like they basically filmed it all. They talked initially about releasing it as like an 18 episode season, and they were like, yeah, actually, we don't want to do that because why bother? So they announced that they're going to basically try and do it more like older style television. They want to do a season a year. So now they've got two in the can, this one and next one, so that even if they're working ahead, they could probably keep slow horses pace if they wanted to and do 8-9 episodes a year.
Yeah. So my question now, the big question was the thing, did Matt do it on purpose? But so if this is the last episode, is Matt going to spend the rest of the time in a hospital bed? Because, I mean, he just took a shot to the chest, right?
He certainly did. And
going to have a collapsed lung and all that kind of nonsense, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the only thing that occurred to me is perhaps, as you say, perhaps his smashing Dex's face, perhaps him getting Dex out, and perhaps him jumping in front of there is all part of a larger ruse. And he's not actually hurt. That was all staged or whatever. I don't know. Again, it's interesting.
Yeah, because he shows up late because he was talking to Dex, right?
Yeah, because he has to go all the way to Riker's Island.
Right, yeah.
But then he also goes to Josie's, right?
Yes, yeah.
Because there's that whole scene where he's trying to piece together, like, what happened that night. And that's where Josie mentions that Foggy was drinking a specific type of booze that he only drank when he won cases, and he was drinking ahead of time. And yeah,
maybe he knew something. Maybe there's some inside work happening there. Yeah.
Yep. I must say, it's disappointing to have the swordsman come back from the Hawkeye series and just be like, you know, showing up in tuxedos at parties. I knew that he had been cast. I knew that he was going to be in this, which made sense because also the Daredevil, Kingpin, you know, it's all set in the same area. Kingpin was in the Hawkeye series. It all makes sense. I'm like, kind of a bummer. And even this one, he acknowledges that he was a swordsman. He's like, well, I don't really do that anymore. And he's like, still, I'm going to blackmail you. I don't know. I like that character. I thought he was like super fun when he like, you know, got the sword out in the Hawkeye series. I think it was kind of fun to see more of that, but maybe season two, who knows?
Yeah, he was in something else too. I tried to find the actor.
He'll be part of the new Defenders next, 3 years from now.
Oh, is he?
I don't know. Jaime, any hypotheses?
Tony Dalton is his name.
Any hypotheses, Jaime, on where this is going in the last episode for the season?
I don't really have a strong hypothesis for the final episode because they've got the two main folks in both of their public and private lives sort of clashing together, right? You've got this other question where they focused a lot on the guy who's now the deputy mayor of communications, that, you know, if Fisk is the kingpin, is this guy like the baby pin, the prince pin? I don't know if he has a name in the comics that's like that, but he's the perfect example. In fact, I think it might be Daredevil in the She-Hulk series that talks about the difference between henchmen and goons, right? Goons are just like hired people. They do it for the money, and henchmen actually believe. And this guy seems to believe in what Fisk is doing. You know, he's a true believer, and he's building himself up very similarly, building up power.
The talker dude or young kid?
The younger guy that is leaning on the reporter. and made her report that it was actually the task force that took out Muse instead of Daredevil and the psychiatrist.
Oh, you mean Phony Soprano?
Phony Soprano. There you go. So it feels like he's getting a pretty big part in what's a relatively short series. So I'm kind of curious how they land that plane too. That's why I'm really confused. Like, okay, main character is supposedly bleeding out on the floor. Fisk and his wife have rekindled their love over, you know, murder and violence.
And they canceled their therapy sessions.
Yeah, yeah.
Another interesting move.
Sometimes introducing a third into the relationship spices things up and rekindles the romance.
Yeah. Oh, and I think it was interesting that Vanessa, I guess her name is, deals with the ex-lover, right? To please her man or to sort of get out of that situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Put him out of his misery too, I guess. The Tony Dalton also was in Better Call Saul. That's why he was one of the Salamancas. And
he was amazing. He was so good in that. Yeah.
I thought he played the old man as a young guy, but there's a picture here of the two of them together.
No. He plays this like really, it's not dissimilar. I mean, Tony's got a vibe, but he plays this really smarmy, great character. He has these great interactions with what's his name? The guy, he's the lead villain from Breaking Bad. What the heck was his name? Giancarlo Esposito.
Him. Yeah.
I can't remember the character name.
Gus Fring.
Fring, that's right. Yeah, he has a great couple of great scenes with Gus in Better Call Saul. Really good.
Alrighty, time to move on to the watch list. Shall we do that? All right. Well, a new trailer came out, and I've got One Last Time, He Promises, and this is the trailer for Mission Impossible: The Final Reckoning, Part 1 of 3. I'm sure. Where this time Tom Cruise hangs off a helicopter and a plane, you know, so yeah. Last one he drove a motorcycle off a mountain, apparently, trying to get a win an Academy Award that was non-existent. So, enough said about that. That's coming out in a few months, I think.
May 23rd, 2025.
May, right, yeah. So we'll go and see that one, see if it blows up real good. Speaking of blowing up real good, also Murderbot, the trailer for Apple TV came out this week, I guess, with one of the Sarsgaards. Can never remember which one's which. It's almost like the Baldwin brothers. There's so many of them, right?
Are these ones actually related, or is Sarsgaard the equivalent of like Smith?
No, he's the son of the guy from the Thor movies.
Okay,
cool. Isn't he, John?
Which one?
The guy who plays the Sarsgaard that plays in Murderbot is the son of the actor who plays.
Yeah, he's Stellan Skarsgård's son.
Yeah,
and he was the guy.
Them, isn't there?
Yeah, he does. He was the one who was in It and in.
Was he the monster in It?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah,
I never saw the guy who played Frankenfurter in Rocky Horror Picture Show. I never saw him do his version of it either.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So that's coming out. It looks like an interesting series about an android that I guess develops a personality. Sort of got a Mickey 17 kind of vibe to it, right? Yeah. I mean, from what I gathered from the trailer, it's kind of like he's a new type of house bot or droid or whatever, and he can. The people around him ignore him and say bad things about it, and they're like, ah, he's not listening, he's not really paying attention. And yet in the narration he says, as a matter of fact, I was listening, but I was also watching the series on the YouTube at the same time, right? It was kind of funny. And yesterday I watched Flow, the Academy Award winning or Golden Globe Award winning animation.
I believe it won the Academy Award for Best Animated Picture, didn't it?
Yeah, I think so. So it's interesting. It was a little Jonathan Livingston Seagull kind of. But the interesting story behind this is one of the things about the Vision Pro is that the audio is over the ear audio. So if you're in the room with somebody watching something on Vision Pro, you can hear the audio, right? And not super loud. It's louder on the person wearing it. Some people like to wear like earbuds when they're using the Vision Pro, but you get the sort of same, you know, spatial audio and all that kind of stuff effects. But I was sitting on the couch and Sorsha, my dog, was sitting on the couch with me. And when she heard the dogs and the cats and stuff and the birds in the beginning, like the first 5 minutes of the movie, she's like sitting up looking around the room. So I took off the Vision Pro and put it on the TV, and the two of us watched it for the first half of the movie. And then she got bored and went off and did something else. But yeah, it's an interesting story. I'm not sure what the gist of the story is, but it's kind of like there's a disaster and it brings all the characters, which are all animals, together. You know, some of them are natural enemies. But yeah, it's almost like a dream state kind of thing, but I don't know if it's a tsunami or something that hits an island that these creatures live on. And
yeah, I think it's supposed to be a flood. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause it floods and then it goes away at the end. Spoilers, but you know, but I think it's all about the relationship between these animals and how they, you know, anthropomorphize and save each other in the end, as you know, all wild animals do, right?
Sure.
Yeah. It's an interesting movie. It's definitely worth a watch. It was, I don't know if I would, I guess if I was comparing it to other animated films, I might put it up there, but personally, I enjoyed the Wallace and Gromit movie more than this, but then again, that's because I'm into that character and those people, as it were, not that they're not people. All right. So over to Jaime for his picks or watch list stuff.
Yeah, I've got one here. It's a company called Make Three, and they produce really cool props. You can check out their work. They've got a variety of things that they did for Severance Season 2. The one that I liked a lot was the Lumen Industries Woe Meter, one that they use in the Chikai Bardo episode to measure Gemma's woe, you know, one of the four tempers. And it's pretty cool. Like, they show the concept art and what they ended up producing and how it works under the covers. It's like, you know, it's not a real woe meter, but it is a real tangible working device that the actors could use and interact with without having to use CGI to fill things in after the fact. And they note here that having been shown only concept renders and only having 6 weeks until the shooting schedule of the episode, they were still able to get something over the finish line. So I thought that was pretty neat to have this tangible, you know, old timey kind of 60s, 70s era classic sci-fi kind of vibe that Severance has included the entire way. It's fit right in.
Well, we're all run by a bunch of Raspberry Pis and some LED lights and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
People will be making their own now that they've seen this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All right, well, I'm up. The first thing I've got on here is a weird video that dropped this week, and maybe it was caused because of the patience people show during the 5-hour rollout of a bunch of director's chairs to announce the Avengers Doomsday Day lineup. Marvel decided to double down, and so they have now got an 8-hour long video on YouTube of Hugh Jackman staring intensely into the camera and breathing wearing his Wolverine uniform. I have not watched the whole thing because that would be lunacy, but I'm told that he does in fact move slightly somewhere around the middle and then does the same thing again for another 4 hours. It's really, 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 really random. And I'm sure someone out there is like, great, I can listen to Hugh Jackman breathe while I sleep, but it's very weird. It's very weird. It's worth checking out, even if for just 30 seconds, to be like, okay, I got it. But it's 8 hours worth. Yeah, it's pretty strange. Saw it earlier this week and thought everyone should have to see this because I saw it.
Yeah, I did. I did sit and watch it for a bit and waiting for something to happen, and then realized it was just him breathing.
Yeah, you got to go into the comments. There's people with time codes, and then people saying, "Hey, you missed a couple of time codes."
Oh, really?
Yeah, 5131, 14308, 23445. But hey, what about this one too?
Places where he moves even slightly.
Yeah, there's one where. So now, if you go to 5133, you can see that he's much closer to the camera, and he's got his claws extended.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So kudos to the person.
You actually think he did this for 8 hours, or he didn't loop it?
I mean, I'm sure they looped it in with like him actually doing some movements.
Could be an AI for all we know too.
True.
Yeah. It's pretty weird and it's pretty random. The other things I just want to flag is we have a couple new things coming this weekend. We've got Doctor Who coming on Saturday, and we've got Last of Us coming on Sunday. So that's pretty exciting. New season of Doctor Who, kicking off a new companion, new adventures, more Nchuti Gawa, who we love. So I'm excited to see what they do to sort of bring that back for season two, what kind of course corrections they might make, how this looks. So I'm excited about that. And then, I mean, The Last of Us, I mean, what can we say? That first season was just really tremendous television. And I have not played Last of Us 2, so I'm coming in a little bit cold. Tim, I think you've played the whole thing. So you can be our Sherpa through this as to whether we're on track or off track. But yeah, I mean, if this compares any way to the first season, this is going to be a really special television event. And we're going to have a third season, because I did actually see before we signed on that they've already confirmed that they're going to do a third season. So they're splitting the second game into two seasons.
Well, there's two games in the second game.
Yeah, I suppose that's one way of looking at it, right?
Yeah, because there's a kind of like a prequel episode or mid game episode with Ellie by herself with another person, and then there's the main story, right, which carries on from where we left off with the two of them getting beyond the rim and they have to go and find some place to settle, right?
Yeah. And if you are fans of these shows, I expect we will be talking about them over the next few weeks, because Daredevil wraps up next week. And yeah, we'll talk some Who, we'll talk some Last of Us, and very soon, very, very soon, we'll start talking Andor. So this is going to be a really good month for nerdy folk like us.
Yeah, and like if you're wondering, if you don't listen to the after show last week, is when we discussed what we're doing with the animated series, we're going to take a break from that while we talk about the other shows are going to occupy our brain space, and then we'll come back to the anime series later on after we get done with Andor and Doctor Who and The Last of Us and all that stuff.
And now we know that Strange New Worlds is coming, quote unquote, summer. So, we'll hopefully, we have lots of stuff to cover us through spring now, and that'll carry us right into more new Star Trek. So that'll be fun.
All right. Well, I guess that's it for the week. So, Jonathan, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
You can find me on Blue Sky and Instagram is at JPK News, or you can find me on YouTube at youtube.com/@JPK.
All right. And then, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
I'm on Instagram as @DevOfTheHair.
Right, my name is Timitra, TimMitra is my handle on Blue Sky, on Mastodon, on Threads, and also this new thing, well, I don't know if it's new or whatever, but on Substack, and maybe in the after show, Jaime can explain to me what the hell that is. And so until next time, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to the Spotcast Podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spotcast website at spotcast.com. If you have feedback or questions, you can get in touch with us on the website. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/spotcast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spotcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.
Substack. I mean, it's funny because I'm seeing a lot of, I've had an account for a while, but a couple of years or whatever, and I never went back to it. And then I'm seeing a lot of people like Rosie O'Donnell just joined Substack and John Cleese is on there. So I wonder if it's a place where people who are leaving Twitter have kind of ended up.
It's weird because Substack is kind of like, you remember Medium, medium.com? Yeah. Okay, so take that, but bolt onto it newsletters. So it's not just, hey, I sure hope you show up to my Medium. It's like, hey, you can sign up for my newsletter that will bring you to my Substack. I think they do have some sort of video and/or podcast type stuff, although I've not really seen any of that, because that's all been behind the paywall, and I'm too cheap to pay the people who I follow for free on some things. But I got the impression that it was, you know, not quite the same as like a Twitter or et cetera, because it's not, as far as I've seen, I've never seen any like, oh, here's like a feed of everything. It's like you're kind of more like an RSS. Hey, I'm subscribed to The Verge. Oh, hey, I'm subscribed to Ars Technica. You know, I'm subscribed to Simon Taylor for his takes on fintech. I'm subscribed to John Pitts for his open banking policy stuff. Like, this is the things that I'm actually subscribed to. And so it does feel very much like a more modern take on Medium.com.
Yeah, I mean, I follow Medium.com because a lot of technology stuff that I read about is people post their, I guess it's a place to post like tutorials and stuff that they write, whereas I had my own site for 25 years now, folks. Yes, that's right, 25 years. But that's one of the reasons I go to Medium. But Substack just kept coming up in my discussions, and like Patty Smith, I'm following her on there. I find that I'm following people because some of the people that I made the mistake of hitting the subscribe button for started inundating me with email, right? So I just went back and just turned into a regular follower, right? So, I spend most of my time on Threads because there's 47 different reasons why you do that. But then I also look at Blue Sky for technology stuff. And sometimes I remember to go back and look at Mastodon, but not so much anymore. And I think probably because the app that I use doesn't really scroll correctly and kind of a pain in the ass to use, but then just sort of stumbled across Substack, and I get notifications from them, and occasionally I'll go and check out what people are saying about it. But it's funny, like I was saying, it seems like a lot of boomers are on there, right? All of a sudden, celebrity boomers, that is, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen people migrating there for, you know, replacing some of the traditional social media they've moved over there, and then some people are supplementing it, so they're giving you tastes of stuff on their social media, and then they're pushing you to the Substack to try and do that. So like there's some journalists and some broadcasters and stuff like that I follow that are doing that, you know, people in Washington and places like that are trying to sort of be independent, because that is part of their brand, is like, I don't work for one of these major media corporations. I'm trying to do my own thing and not be lumped in with the rest.
So what else? Are you guys going to talk about March Madness now?
March Madness?
Nope.
I mean,
it's over now. Final Four, whatever they call it.
Spoilers, there's a winner.
Say it again?
Oh, I mean, both tournaments are over. The Connecticut Huskies won the women's, and the Florida Gators won the men's.
Mm-hmm. And not Duke, because not Duke.
Because not Duke.
I think there was a lot of hate on for Duke because it's very bougie place. But they were the favorites and they did not win. And that was a crazy finish to both those games, the semifinals and the finals. Did you guys watch White Lotus?
Yes.
No, I've not seen that series, so you all are totally fine there.
Are we free to talk about it?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, it was, this was the longest season that they'd ever done. It was 8 episodes. The first season was 6, second one was 7, this one's 8. 8's too much, it was too long. It was really good at times, but it was also just a little too drawn out, and some stuff was a little telegraphed.
Yeah, like the Darth Vader connection?
Yeah, like that was obvious. I said to my wife before we sat down, I correctly called several of the deaths that happened in the final.
Oh, really? Episode. Oh, okay. Okay. Okay.
Just because they had really like, I mean, Mike White's an interesting content creator in that he's really got some stuff that he's interested in exploring, and he definitely likes to push people's buttons. And yeah, there was definitely some stuff in there that was really the way that he used, you know, like foreshadowing and some imagery that kind of led you down the path of what was going to happen. But also, if you watch the first 2 seasons, his sort of overarching theme of this show is that we are all the result of our own actions and decisions, and that if you have enough money, you can get away with almost anything. That is the recurring theme through the first three seasons of this show now. So when you go in with that mindset, you're like, well, clearly this person's going to get their comeuppance, and that person's going to get their comeuppance, and this person's going to make a bad choice. And yeah, I mean, it was a weird final episode. We had, you know, one person kind of get the comeuppance they deserved, another person get their comeuppance based on that, and then a couple of people turned to the dark side. So, you know, it was definitely very much in the mold of White Lotus so far. But yeah, but it was still good television. I mean, it's tremendously well made. It's beautiful to look at. The acting is terrific. Like, I think this was the worst season of it. And by that, I mean, it was a solid B as opposed to an A plus. It's still good. It's just, it wasn't as good as what they'd done before, but yeah, I don't know. What'd you think?
Yeah, no, I thought that, I'm glad the kid didn't die. You know, I thought that was interesting. And it was kind of the spiral, the Jason Isaacs character spiral, was interesting, like, from that point of view. I saw the Darth Vader thing. I mean, I didn't nail it, but yeah, when you find out the connection, I was not surprised, right? And you know, it's kind of one of those, I mentioned this before, it's like the Lucy in the chocolate factory kind of thing. You just look at the screen and you're screaming, don't do that, what are you doing, you know? Yeah, so it was a good show. I mean, I liked the triangle of the three women. Somebody said that this, or I think one of the interviews I saw, it was all about threes, right? Because there's three women, there's the triangle with, you know, Walt Goggins' character and his girlfriend, right? Yeah, and the brothers. Oh my god. It's funny, I saw Jason Isaacs on I think it was Jimmy Kimmel last night, right? Talking about this, and at the end of it, was it Jimmy Kimmel? Oh no, yeah, one of the shows, I can't remember which one it was, but he hands him a pina colada at the end. and Jason Isaacs, look, like, you know, he's like, you know, well, let's trade, you give me yours, and then he finally goes and gives it to one of the people in the audience. Yeah, because that's the clip they showed, was him knocking the glasses out of everybody's hand, right?
yeah. Well, I'm glad he didn't hand him a prosthetic phallus either, because that could have come up also.
Yeah, that's true. Could have come up in many ways.
Yes. Yeah. It. Again, I think it's still a show that I look forward to seeing. It's always... You know, I heard somebody say in a podcast I was listening to that, you know, it's like taking a trip without having to take a trip. Like, you kind of feel like you're on vacation because they're all on vacation. I'm like,
without the heat. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's funny, too, because I saw a couple of interviews with some of the cast who were like, it was so hot, like so unbelievably hot. I'm like, OK, yeah, all right. But
and why no bugs? That's what I didn't get, right?
Well, so. I mean, they did show that one scene in the final episode. Yeah,
fogging.
They were fogging in the final episode, and I was like, is that okay? Are we allowed to just, you know,
DDT
throw a little DEET in the woods there? Like, yeah. No, it was, again, I would say, I don't think it was quite up to the scratch that they'd done for the first couple seasons, but it was still great entertainment. And you know, they always get a terrific mix of actors. I mean, Carrie Coon is terrific in this. I thought she was fantastic. I must admit, I was so taken by her. I never watched The Leftovers. Did you watch The Leftovers?
You know what she was in? She was in Fargo. You got to watch Fargo. I think she's in, not the one with the John Hamm, but the series before that.
Yeah.
She plays the cop that, like, she as a she's a female cop, and she's pretty much invisible in the entire show, like, but she's like she's the main person figuring out what's going on, and like so much so that when she goes to like the Atlantic Superstore, the doors won't open for her.
Yeah.
And when she goes to wash her hands in the sink just doesn't recognize that she's even waving her hand, right? So it's kind of a running joke throughout the whole series. But yeah, she plays the... And I think that the thing about Fargo is there's a thread that connects all of the seasons, right? Like I think in the first, in the TV show version, the first season is this female cop, and then the second season is her father, right? Who is played, he's a character in the first season, but they go back to him as a young man, and he's the guy from, one of the guys from The Watchmen, one of the actors from The Watchmen. And then there's like, then we come back to Carrie Coons, and Carrie Coons is a cop in this same sort of town or vicinity, and she's related to them somehow too, right? So it's really interesting the way they tie them all together, right? And then and they have Ewan McGregor playing twins, and it's a good show.
Who else is in that? Oh, it's that's where he met his wife, right? That's where
is that they met there?
Ewan McGregor and what's her name?
Mary Elizabeth.
Yeah, Mary Elizabeth Winstead. Yeah, that's where they met, and now they're married with a kid. Yeah. But yeah, like the Leftovers series is one that I had never gotten around to. That's the one about the Rapture that was on HBO a few years ago, and I've heard people say it's fantastic, but I just never found the time for it. It's it's on Crave for us, but
Justin Theroux again.
Yeah, it's Justin Theroux and Carrie Coon. The idea is that like 140 million people basically disappear in a blink of an eye. And many people believe that it's the Rapture, which means that if that's the Rapture and those people got called to wherever they were supposed to go to, then everyone who's left behind is the Leftovers.
Got a Doctor Who in it too.
Yeah. So I've been meaning to add that to my list, but again, it's an hour long drama and it's, I think, three or four seasons. So it's
2014 to 2017. Yeah.
Yeah. So
28 episodes. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And the new season of Hack starts tonight too.
Yeah, Stephen got back. She was on, Jean Smart was on the interview circuit the other day.
Yeah.
Actually, both of them were.
Yeah, I'm like just deeply obsessed with Hannah Einbinder now. Like, yeah. She's just so interesting.
Yeah. No, it's a good, like I said, I watched the first half of the first season and really enjoyed it. Just never got back to it.
Yeah.
That and You're Dead to Me. I think I'm on season three and I kind of stopped watching it.
Yeah. It's worth finishing that one. My wife and I watched that one through. And enjoyed it.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't watch probably didn't watch The Leftovers because of all the religiosity stuff, you know, so.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, think of it as the less comedic version of This Is the End with Seth Rogen.
Yeah, which I don't think I've seen.
What?
Is that the one with, like, all the actors?
Yeah, it's the one where it's, like, him and Jay Baruchel.
Franco.
And they are all basically, like, the Rapture comes, and they're all, like, at a house party in L.A., and then they have to try and survive it. You've not seen that?
I've seen that one, yeah.
Oh, my God. I think I've probably seen that movie, like, 12 times. I think it's...
Really?
It's
I watched it once.
So funny. Oh, my God. It's worth a rewatch just to watch Rihanna just... Michael Cera within the first 10 minutes of the movie is so funny because he told her, like, don't hold back, hit me, and he hit her so hard he actually damaged his eardrum.
Oh really
she hit him so hard in that actress, moment, because he slaps her on the ass and she turns around and just cracks him across the side of the head, and she just cupped her hand so it like popped his eardrum. Yeah, I love that movie. It's just so over the top.
Cool. All right, well, I'm gonna go and do something different.
All right. Well, then let us reconvene next Thursday.
All righty then.
All right.
Talk to you guys later.
All right. Talk to you later. Take care, guys.
Bye. Bye.